Hello and welcome to the This Week in Cleantech podcast. Each week, our host, David Hunt, speaks to a leading startup, CEO, executive, thought leader, or industry insider in the cleantech sector. Focused on the clean energy and clean mobility transitions, each guest shares the highs and lows of their cleantech journey, their industry insights, and their vision and hopes for the future.
Hello and thank you for joining me again on the This Week in Cleantech podcast, brought to you by Hyperion Executive Search, the global cleantech executive search firm. My guest this week is Gideon van Dijk. Gideon is the CEO and co-founder of ChargeTrip, a company accelerating the advent of sustainable mobility. Over the last 2 years, Gideon and his team have taken ChargeTrip from a small startup to an emerging navigation company solving routing optimization problems for well-known automotive clients and OEMs. Gideon is a UWC Atlantic alumni, an ex-RNLI crew member, which is awesome, and a serial entrepreneur. Holding multiple leadership and advisory positions, Gideon currently lives in Amsterdam with his wife and, as of recently, 2 children. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hey, Gideon, it's great to have you last on the This Week in Cleantech podcast. Thanks for joining us from Amsterdam.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
One of my favorite cities in the world, actually. How are things there with lockdown? Obviously, the streets, I guess, are relatively good for cyclists, which is always the case in Amsterdam. But how is the situation there?
Yeah, no issues there at all. It's been good, I must say. Like, we've been one of the nations, I think, that's been pretty good in their response. It's been very easy to get to the office, though. There's no traffic at all, so that's been good. We celebrated King's Day yesterday, which was very weird. So that's a big Dutch tradition, which we, you know, I think this is the first year in, as far as I can remember, that it was very different from usually. So typically what you'd see is kids going outside and selling things on the street, and just there's parties all throughout the city. So that was, that didn't happen this year. But for the rest, it's all good. It's a bit, it's a very strange new reality we're dealing with. But so far, so good.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll return to that, in particular around mobility, which is, of course, a very hot topic and key to ChargeTrip. So we'll return to that. But I always like to just give people a bit of a sense of context. So perhaps if you could share a little bit, Gideon, of your journey to start or to co-found ChargeTrip, a little bit of your early career and why, what led you to become an entrepreneur, what led you to form ChargeTrip?
Sure, happy to. First of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. David, it's a pleasure. So my background is pretty much has always been in startups. I have worked as a consultant for a bit, but I've always had my own company in one shape or form. I've always been a little bit torn between academics and entrepreneurship. I love researching stuff, and I love building stuff, and I think combining those, it makes perfect sense to have your own business. And for me, I don't really do well with frameworks or rules, for that matter. So having your own business.
Born entrepreneur,
perfect,
then.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. But I have always, like, pursuing a business, it does mean that you have to deal with a lot of the sort of more boring aspects, like the administrative stuff, managing. So sometimes I do miss academics a little bit. I think I, to get it, so we're 4 founders. It's not just me. It's myself, Peter, Mark, and Andreas, and we're essentially a group of friends. And we came together a couple of years ago. We're all from very different backgrounds, but we came together because we shared this deep interest in the renewable energy transition. And the one thing that sparked this was Mark is an early EV adopter. He used to live in Norway. He's an early EV adopter, and he always wondered why, whenever he had to go on a longer trip for work or to go to his family holiday house or something like that, he would always use his ICE car, even though he had a Tesla at the moment. And he also had, I think he had, one of his businesses had a Kia Soul. I think it was a really early Kia Soul. And he would never use those either because the people that he was traveling with wouldn't want to do it in an EV, or he was scared of not finding a charge station. And it just seemed like such a step back, you know, having this new technology, having this new mobility paradigm, but then you know, not always feeling confident using it. Yeah. And so we thought we had to do something about that. And ever since we've been developing new navigation paradigms for electric vehicles, because we think it's super important that people are very confident driving these cars and that people adopt them with the least amount of barriers possible. I think that in a nutshell is our background story.
Sure. No, I love that entrepreneurial element of, you know, a problem which occurs in your own life, and then suddenly it sparks something in your mind or collective minds in terms of having some friends who talk of the situation and then find a germ of a solution that you can then elaborate on. I'm also really intrigued a little bit, you touched on sort of the difference between academia and obviously founding or entrepreneurialism. A lot of the CEOs we have come from so many broad and varied backgrounds. Some have come from academics, some from PhDs, some from the technical side, some have been entrepreneurs since selling sweets in the schoolyard at six. So it's, the route to founding a company, I think, is always an interesting one. But there is no fixed idea of what that should be or what that could be. That's what I love about talking to so many interesting leaders, is the backgrounds are so varied and nobody has the same story.
Yeah, I think what we all share is just perseverance, right? If it's this one trait that you would, if you talk to this many entrepreneurs, you probably know, but like tenacity and perseverance is probably what we all share. We see a goal and we want to get there, and we're just gonna bite in and see it through to the end. And that's maybe a large part, that's why sort of academics is interesting, because that's, you know, you are left to your own devices there as well, and you need to stick to it and you need to see it through, and that's way wider, a little bit related. But so tenacity and just sticking with it is something that all entrepreneurs share, I think. For me, sort of academics is, I'm an avid reader. I really like sort of learning things that I didn't know before, like all of us, of course. And academics helps you do that. But I never finished my studies. I did a bit of physics, and then I did a bit of culture management, I think you would translate it as. And I really liked it, but I was just very bad at sticking to the program. I was actually very bad at seeing it through. I'm really good at the first 80% and I suck at the last 20. So that's typically where you would onboard new employees when you get to that point.
But that's that resilience thing that's interesting. Likewise, I actually, didn't complete a number of the studies I started on, but I've read and read dozens of books on at any given sort of moment. So it's interesting. But resilience and perseverance, I think, are critical at any stage, and in particular at the moment. I was actually just listening to Guy Kawasaki's podcast this morning, a very short one on resilience and some of the steps that you can take to cope with the current situation. That's something probably we'll return to. But in those early stages, when there was the four of you founding the business, what were some of the biggest challenges or difficulties that you faced in those early months? Did you start with any funding, for example?
So I think we got a bit, in a sense, a bit lucky that we all came from an entrepreneurial background. We all had other businesses before this one, so we knew what the pitfalls were, and we also had, all of us had a little bit of capital that we could put in. So we didn't need any funding. We could just go ahead, build an MVP, and see how the market would respond to it. And it responded really well. That's when we decided to take it further. But so I guess the main challenge for us was to find a first potential customer for whatever we had built, develop it with them, and onboard the EV community. So back then, and I'm saying that like this is a very long time ago. It's only 4 years ago, but I mean, in terms of maturity of the market back then, 4 years ago is actually a pretty long time in the EV landscape, as I think, you know. So back then, like, Norway was by a long shot the biggest EV market in the world. We came in, so we're our headquarters is in Amsterdam, but we've never actually done anything in the Netherlands in terms of business. So all our business has always been in Germany, the Nordics, Asia Pacific, and the US. So we're heavily focused on the US at the moment. But but we've never actually done anything in the Netherlands. So funnily enough, our first customer was in in the Nordics, in Oslo, the Norwegian EV Association. And we really developed this together with them. Like, finding them was our big break, I'm going to say. I think that was sort of, in the first couple of months, the biggest struggle. So we're kind of building this in splendid isolation. We think we got it right. Like, we think, based on what Mark was doing, based on what we were doing, we think that this is the problem that we're trying to solve. And then you somehow need to see if that value prop, if that's the right value prop, right, for the for the market.
Yeah.
And luckily for us, but you know, that's really luck. That's really happenstance. And you need some of that, obviously, as an entrepreneur.
For sure.
Luckily enough, we found a really great partner in the Norwegian EV Association. They are the biggest EV association in the world, and they're pretty much all early adopters. So they have an opinion. You know what I mean? Like, they will actually tell you if what you build is good or not, and if it's actually helping them. So yeah, we got a really big break, but I think that was our biggest challenge, to sort of find our test case, like find our audience in those early days.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting, actually, because we actually have a number of clients in Amsterdam, and particularly in and around e-mobility. And I think the first time I met Peter, one of your co-founders, was at the Revolution event, which is hosted by EVBox, I think 2 years ago, actually. So that was when we first met. And again, in Amsterdam, of course, you have EVBox, you have Alfen, who are both clients of Hyperion, and then you have Tritium and various other charging infrastructure companies who are based from there. But it's interesting that you didn't really find a local market, and perhaps again we'll return to that. I think it'd be really useful, actually, just because again there's so much talk in and around e-mobility, and to give some clarity to the audience around what exactly it is that Trip do, what exactly is the product solution that you have at this moment in time.
Sure. So we're B2B SaaS, software as a service, API for routing. So we build the tech that helps cars go from A to B. And the reason we do that, and you need that, is because consumption for an electric vehicle is very complex and very different from consumption for ICE cars. So if you're trying to predict where an electric vehicle should stop to charge, you need some intelligence to do that. And that's essentially the bit that we're bringing to the table. We're developing a very straightforward routing engine, but specifically for electric vehicles. So we take into account all the different outside variables that impact the range of a vehicle. So as you know, driving an EV today in Amsterdam, I'm looking outside, it's about 16 degrees and it's raining at the moment for the first time in weeks, which means that today I might be anywhere between 15 to 20% range. I have 20% range less than I would yesterday when it was really sunny. So whenever you see these range scores that car manufacturers give to their cars, you got to keep in mind that's in perfect conditions, right? That's like no wind, empty roads, super sunny, perfect temperature, perfect tarmac. But the reality is completely different. And we are predicting that reality and then applying it to routing. So we tell people, okay, if you want to go from here to here, you have to stop here, here, and here. This is how long you should charge for. This is how much it's going to cost you. These stations are available. These aren't. So we try to take all the puzzle pieces that driving and charging an electric car have out of it. And then we sell that back to car manufacturers and also utilities, charge point operators, electric mobility service providers. We're now trying to get into telematics. So obviously it's a really good idea to electrify your fleet of cars, but then you need to be a little bit better at predicting where to charge those cars. So we're trying to get into that vertical. Essentially, that's the tech that we have.
Okay. I mean, yeah, absolutely. You can see the need for that solution. And as I say, with all of us who do and have driven electric vehicles, as you say, there's that element of unknowing. And of course, there are many more myths and still a lot of talk around range anxiety beyond which exists. But of course, it is an issue. We have to accept that. I think now you can see that there are much more established EV charging infrastructure. So 4 years ago, how did you get the data for what was obviously a far less well-built EV charging infrastructure for starters, and also obviously less EV vehicles perhaps a less understanding of the impact of rate of, I should say, some of those things, temperature in particular, on the range of a vehicle?
Right. So we would harvest it from anywhere we could, essentially. We figured data was the solution to this problem, right? So whenever you're facing a complex optimization problem, data, harvesting data and then modeling data is probably a really good approach to get to some sort of predictive model for it. Yeah. So from like the early days, we were really interested in getting any type of data, whether that's telemetry data from a car or whether it's station data, like you're saying. So we've always done a lot of outreach to get that data. And like early days, we were, you know, if we would approach a CPO, we would either get maybe an Excel sheet with data that didn't have any dynamic data, or we'd get a CSV file, or we'd, you know, sometimes they had an API, but then they wouldn't have dynamic data. So there were a lot of instances where it was just a lot of scraping and harvesting from different sources. And obviously that got better. As the market got more and more mature, we saw the introduction of standards like OCPI and OCPP, and everything became a little bit easier to get that data. But there's still a big problem around data transparency in the EV market. So it's hard. It's still hard to get really good charge station data, right? So there's a lot of super great aggregators that we're partnering with. But in some regions, it still remains really hard to get decent data.
Okay. I mean, there are of course some with varying degrees of accuracy, and even obviously the CPOs themselves have a solution. I guess some of that could be yours because you white label the product, as I understand it, as well as providing directly to sort of B2B partners. So, again, how did you choose the business model? Was it always the case that you would see us white labeling the solution, and that you would sort of essentially provide it in the background for whether that be CPOs or utilities or auto OEMs?
I would say that the markets maybe chose the business model for us. So when a vertical is really young, there is not a lot of, let's say, value added services around that vertical. So from day one, we knew we wanted to build a routing API. We knew we wanted to be the TomTom for electric cars or the HERE for electric cars. We wanted to do this on a large scale, and we wanted to enable developers to do this themselves. So whether those developers are at car manufacturers or utilities didn't really matter. But whenever people got really excited about the platform, and whenever they wanted to integrate it, we always got the question, do you also have a front end for it? Mm-hmm. Which we didn't. There just weren't any front ends for it. So the market essentially told us they needed front ends, and we decided, well, we have this API, so let's just build some front ends on top of it and then white label them. And now we're seeing that we get a lot more requests for just API use. I think as the vertical has matured a bit, we're seeing all these automotives and utilities and CPOs develop their own apps. They have their own driver apps, they have their own charge station apps, and they're just looking to add route planning to that. We switched around a bit between being white label and SaaS only, and we're now moving from the white label to the SaaS bit.
Okay. And again, as is always the case with any startup, as you say, you need to pivot or at least be able to flex the business model and the direction a little bit. I think one of the things that stands out to me is, as I haven't met with Peter and been aware of you guys for a few years as a very small entity and not too many people in the team, is the successes that you've had. And I know globally, because I believe there's solutions active in New Zealand, of course, in Norway, as we've mentioned, but also I think, was it last year you had the tie-up with Porsche, which again is good in many regards. That's again right. from a branding perspective. But how does a small company with a very young and innovative sector find themselves building relationships with the likes of Porsche, which of course everybody would want to work with and is not perhaps the biggest OEM in the world, but still, is an auto OEM. And by definition, those guys often move very slowly.
Well, I guess the easy answer is because we have something they really, really need. That's often the case when, as a startup, you're able to work with these big and incumbent companies. You either you need to have very visionary people there. You need to have someone that they really, really need. And I think probably in our case, it was the first one. So as a lot of automotives are converging and being pulled into this new mobility paradigm, because obviously they don't like it, right? We all know that. But as they're being pulled into that, all these sort of, what I would say almost hygienic factors like routing, or how does an electric drivetrain or skateboard work, or how does battery optimization tech work? You're suddenly, everyone in that organization is confronted with those questions, and you start looking at partners that can solve those for you. And luckily, we were in a market segment where we were one of the first ones doing this. And then I guess the longer answer to this would be a little bit of luck, right? So like we were at the right place at the right time more often. So we participated in an accelerator called Startup Autobahn, which Porsche is a part of. And they're a pretty interesting accelerator because they don't have the traditional mentoring program, but they do pilots with their global partners. So they have a network of global partners, and those partners have some kind of challenge that they want to work on. And in our case, that was EV routing, and we were just, you know, there at the right moment, the right time.
Yeah, I think there's two arguments to that. You can often say you need luck, which I think is absolutely true. But of course, you have to be in the right place at the right time, and you have to have the solution. So, you know, the old adage that you make your own luck is clearly part of that as well. And I think people underestimate sometimes the importance of timing in the success or otherwise of a company.
Absolutely. I think, you know, over the last couple of years, we've constantly been amazed at how bad our timing was and how lucky we got at some, like there seems to be, you know, so much of what we're doing and what we get to do and how we get to grow. It's exactly what you say, right? It's just being there at the right moment in time and having the solution to back that up at the right moment. That makes all the difference. And we, for example, 2 years ago, we thought the market was going way faster than it actually was. Like we were already, you know, we were anticipating a sales pipeline that was just never reality. And then, you know, 2 months later, that actually did take off. So it's just, it's very unpredictable, and you have to be ready, and you need to be there every time at the right time with the right solution. And then you're giving yourself the best shot. You know, and still you could be very unlucky.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's another factor around how, and we've done it ourselves at Hyperion in terms of always or being fortunate that we've recognized where new markets have evolved, whether that's initially through renewables and then through batteries and then through mobility. And we've been able to take advantage of and spot where the next big market opportunities come from. But that's that kind of intuition sometimes is very hard to explain how you as a founder recognize those things. And, you know, as a team of four, I guess that helps a little bit that you talk about these things amongst yourselves. But really just recognizing in how the market might play out and being able to adapt when it doesn't go the way you expect it to, either too slow or too fast.
Right. And that's where, you know, tenacity comes back in. You're going to get it wrong every time, right? You're going to get it wrong, this timing stuff. But you can't be too beaten up by that. And I think every entrepreneur has their they have their fair share of failures. And it's you know, it's how you deal with that and how you go on that in the end gets you to where you are now. That sounds very philosophical. I don't mean it to be so deep, but that's the essential reality of being an entrepreneur. You know, it's going to go wrong a lot of the time.
No, absolutely.
And then it goes right.
And I think every CEO or founder I've had on the podcast, you know, has a story to tell. And there have always been brick walls where, you know, the option would have been, hey, let's quit, but you find a way around it. You find a solution, you keep going, and that resilience kicks in. And
because what's the alternative, you know?
Yeah,
you're gonna stop.
Then you find a bit of luck. So where will people likely, perhaps they have already, or perhaps they're likely to in the near future, have experienced the charge trip solution. And with obviously being white label, they might not recognize it. Now, I had the fortune to sit in a Porsche Taycan at a fully charged live in Austin a while ago, not to drive it, unfortunately. But where will people have seen or utilized charge trip without perhaps knowing about it?
So our platform is in the background. We do the actual routing computation. So you wouldn't necessarily see a ChargeTrip logo anywhere, but we do power driver apps, like an app by the Norwegian Automobile Association, or apps by Porsche, or like you said, apps in New Zealand. We're working on an app actually now in the Netherlands. So 3 years later, we do actually do some business in the Netherlands. So we're typically a little bit in the background. And then there's also developers that just use our service, but that don't need a front end from us. Use the API to do route planning and have their own front end. But essentially, any type of driver app that helps you plan routes, that's something that you would find the ChargeTrip service in. Mm-hmm. And Porsche is a great example of that. So you can use our service on Porsche.com right now.
Okay. And again, it's a great brand for leverage or to make people more aware of yourselves and the credibility that brings. I guess a couple of things that every business every startup encounters and two challenges I see is the big ones, one of which is money and one of which is people. Obviously, we support on the people side. But how have the company, I know you did a fundraise and had Total Ventures and a bit of a fundraise. Is it €2 million, I think, last year or early this year?
So we had a first funding discussion somewhere last year, I think during the summer last year. So it was a long time coming, but so far we've been able to bootstrap the business. Like, we all had a little bit of cash on hand, and then we were actually making some money. So we had some paying clients, but you always go into this, at some point you get into this chicken and egg situation where you have a big pipeline. So there's a huge demand, but you don't really have the people to deliver on those projects. But what do you do first? And then sort of the obvious answer is, of course, you find money to hire those people. So that's what we did. And so we've been setting that up since last year. And then we closed around this January. And we did it with some really interesting VCs, from Norway, from Germany, and from France, Total. Mm-hmm. We closed that in January, and we've been scaling ever since. Obviously, this whole COVID pandemic changed the reality of how you scale a little bit. I don't see too much changes in the market. Like, some projects are being postponed, but it seems like all the big EV launchers are still going ahead, even though the factories might have capacity problems, but everything is still slated to go ahead. So I don't see too big a difference there, but our scaling might be affected a little bit.
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually, because a lot of people reach out to me and say, you know, business must be tough for you guys at the moment because you're, you know, hiring talent. But I won't say that some projects haven't slowed down, but actually the majority, both in Europe and the US, are continuing with the projects that we were assigned for. And in fact, winning a number of new ones, even since the lockdown, that, you know, as I say, you don't want to sort of underplay the importance or the significance and the difficulty of some businesses more than others. Certainly if you're manufacturing and making stuff, physically making stuff, that's far more challenging than if you're coding or providing some more form of service or software. Makes it a little bit easier. But it's good to hear that, the cars are still being launched and that people are still pushing forward with as much as they can presently.
I think everyone's still super convinced that electric mobility is the future. And that is all going ahead. There might be, you know, a short hiatus on sort of adoption, like the acceleration of adoption might hold a little bit. But
come back to that in a moment.
Come off for the summer.
Yeah, Yeah, we'll come back to that in a moment. One thing that I find really interesting also is, of course, we work with and I speak to a lot of VCs and investors, and the argument over a sole founder versus a team of founders, and there's obviously pros and cons to both. But I think generally there's an acceptance that more founders within reason, as long as everybody gets on, is a plus point. Going back to that fundraising, because I know how time intensive and how difficult that is, regardless of the sum of money, it's just hard work and a lot of time and effort. I guess that might have been a little bit easier with four founders where you could spread the responsibility, or somebody leads on the fundraising while others lead on product development, for example? Or how has that sort of been to your advantage, do you think, having the four of you as founders?
That was a really good question, because fundraising is super, super time consuming. It really is. You're essentially onboarding new team members, right? It's courting, onboarding all at the same time. And you have to find people that truly believe in your business. And then you also have to, there's a lot of selections going on, and there's also a lot of paperwork and legal stuff going on. Yeah. So it is super time consuming. I guess, you know, the more people you have to help with that, the easier it is. I'll have to get back to this one, David. I'm a little bit torn. I think you're right that it is easier if you have a broader base. But there's also something. VCs are super interested in the 18-year-olds in a garage type, right? Mm-hmm. And so being more established, being sort of a little bit out of the early R&D phase, having your first customer, but not really being sure how to play the market yet, being in clean tech, being in e-mobility, where traditionally for VCs, it's a little bit harder to kind of play the future, like the, do you know what I mean? Like it's a little bit trickier to have a long-term view on where the market is going. Maybe that's also a little bit of a disadvantage. I'm a little bit stuck between them, but you're definitely right that it's extremely time intensive and you really need a longer approach. And it's not, you know, if you think we're going to do this in 6 months, it's going to take you 8. If you think we're going to do it in 8, it's probably going to take you a year. Yeah, it's really like that. So you need to prepare for that. And we actually probably need to start preparing for the next round at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things. You know, once you never stop fundraising and never stop networking. And the same, I think, applies to talent. Be interesting to get your thoughts on that. Again, a lot of the clients that we work with, you know, are constantly thinking about, you know, we might not need this next skill set right now, but it's going to happen sooner or later. And we need to be prepared for that. So it's always being, I think, as an entrepreneur, ready for the next roadblock or road bump, which is always going to happen, but also even if things go to plan, whether it's more money or more people or more resources, always being, I guess, prepared to, it's going to take longer than you expected and be harder than you expected.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we, you know, have an interesting combination of the vertical that we're in and the stage that we're in that makes us attractive to talent. Like startups are traditionally always attractive to talent, mm-hmm. because you get this massive amount of freedom. There's always more to do than what you were hired for, right? So you always have this ability to grow into new and interesting things that you might want to explore. So traditionally it's always a really, at least to me, it's always a really attractive type of business to go into. So there's, I would say, never a shortage on talent. Finding the right people is extremely important, though. Like they make or break the business. I know that you guys help with that, but it's extremely important, especially if you're a startup. You just don't have the luxury of switching out people or the luxury of getting it wrong, really. Mm-hmm. Essentially, your business, and it's, I think, also what you were getting at with, you know, having founders or how VCs look at startups and at the team, it's extremely crucial. If the team is right, then you essentially have a business. Yeah. If you know, so you can't really afford to make any mistakes there.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's, as you say, and there's it could be a double-edged sword because, again, everybody, but a lot of people like the idea of working on the startup, but not everybody realizes it's not all Google sort of beanbags and slides in the middle of the office. It's actually
it's pretty hard work.
And, if you're, and again, no disrespect, but if you're stuck in the middle of a Siemens or an ABB or, you know, any big corporate, it can be quite a leap sometimes. Not to say it's impossible, of course not. We do help people make those transitions, but it's not everything that people sometimes perceive it to be. And I think that's the important thing for startups. And obviously the part we play at Hyperion is to try and manage that process, because being attractive is one thing, but attracting the right people and people who understand that actually this is going to be real hard work. And actually, yeah, you know, you can see two or three paychecks down the line, but beyond that,
how do you retain talent? If it's not being able to fall back on this big organization with a lot of money and benefits, how do you retain talent? How do you keep people interesting? How do you make it a life decision that people stick with for a couple of years rather than a couple of months? That's definitely challenging.
Yeah.
But again, exactly. I think purpose-driven businesses and impact-driven businesses, they typically attract people that are really up for a challenge like that. And you're right. You know, if you come from a very big corporation and you've worked in really big teams, then coming to a startup might be a little bit daunting, especially if you've been in management functions and stuff like that. It's you know, you really have to get your hands dirty again.
Exactly.
And some people are super up for that challenge, and for other people it can be a difficult transition. It
can be difficult for sure. Okay. Let's move on a little bit, because at the moment with the COVID situation, lockdown, there's two real schools of thought in terms of, I try not to read too much news other than sort of selective media, but you know, there are some people, I had Jigar Shah on the podcast last week, who was quite pessimistic about the recession that might follow what's going on. You hear others who of course, there's a lot of talk about how clean the air is in most cities now around the world because of the lack of pollution, and that hopefully that'll stimulate people to think, hey, maybe we should, this is a nice thing, let's just drive EVs, because that's going to help that transition. So I think as entrepreneurs, we're always eternally optimistic and perhaps lean towards that side. But how do you see, you know, once we do come out of whatever normal comes to that e-mobility will accelerate because of the situation presently, or do you think it's going to make it harder for OEMs to continue with the journey? What's your gut feel for how the next 1 or 2 years might look?
Wow.
Get the crystal ball out.
that's a big question. I think it's very so in my nature to be a little bit pessimistic about what's going to happen. I think, you know, people, to a large part, their behavior is perverse, right? They take the path of least resistance. So getting someone to change, getting someone to change behavior is extremely difficult. Getting them to adopt a new reality is very difficult. I'd say one of the really interesting things, one of the really positive things about this whole pandemic is that we've seen that there, you know, as a species, we are able to react, to respond to something that's so challenging in such short time period. It's a shame that we haven't been able to show that same response towards climate change so far. Mm-hmm. But it's extremely positive to see that we actually can do this, right? You know, we can change national budgets. We can change the way we move around. And we all do that, and we stick to that, and we see the importance. That's extremely positive to me. But on the other hand, after like a big, you know, as if you read through history, people forget about these things very quickly again, right? Once they subside. And what I think we'll end up with globally is a pretty significant deficit everywhere. E-mobility is still a price-challenged good, if that makes sense. It, you know, we haven't reached cost parity everywhere. We might have for some like lighter vehicles, but definitely not in all regions. We've had good subsidy rules around Europe, but they're not definitive. And I'm thinking they're one of the first ones to go if nations need cash again. Mm-hmm. So I think we will notice it, and we will put sort of less capital towards accelerating the advent of sustainable transportation over the coming years, which is completely natural given the circumstances, but might sort of set us back. So I think I probably would agree with your last week's guest that it will take us some time to get back there, but I really hope it's not the case.
Yeah, I think it's, as I say, as an entrepreneur, you tend to veer towards, well, from what you're saying, not everybody does perhaps, but towards the optimistic. I think certainly would like to see that the momentum was already existed with Greta and everything else in terms of, you know, the drivers were there. And hopefully people, I should say, won't forget the fact that governments can do things quickly if they really need to. But the other thing, going back to our starting point around resilience, as I think what it's really taught a lot of the startup leaders that I talk with is that cash is king, and you really need to be cash resilient as well as physically and mentally resilient at these times, and probably will be for the next few years. I'm sure VC funding will still flow. We certainly have clients who are still getting VC funding, but I'm sure it won't be as...
It will be harder. It will really be harder. And that goes, and that's on a national level, that's within the EU, that same paradigm counts everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. During these times, cash in hand is king. And I think what you sort of, one of the things that has been really successful within the general adoption of electric mobility, but also other types of clean tech products, right? Solar, wind, is incentives, governmental incentives. So a large part of the reason why adoption in Norway, for example, has been so rampant, and why they were at one point the biggest EV country in the world, is because they were extremely generous at subsidizing this. Mm-hmm. Right. And another thing is carbon tax, of course, which I'm a big advocate for. But subsidizing the purchase of an EV is essentially what led to their massive uptake.
Yeah.
And I'm a little bit afraid that we're going to see less subsidies over the coming times. And that's definitely going to have an impact. Unless we are able to produce these cars so cheaply that they just become the better option. But at the moment, they're unfortunately not.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many drivers, going back to Dieselgate and actually carbon taxes and so many variables. I think that's both creates opportunities, of course, and challenges. And the biggest challenge, I think, is for any leader to see through or to guide a path and to adapt a business model to cope through that. And that's, I think, what keeps us all on the edge of our seats and enjoying it, even in the difficult times.
Yeah, absolutely. it makes it very interesting.
no boredom ever. Just closing out, because you talked about reading, you know, being a prodigious reader of books. So I'm always keen to close out with a little bit again of backstory, if you like. If there are any either books or mentors or thought leaders or sources that you fall back on for inspiration to keep you going and to keep you resilient.
Another awesome question. I've been reading, at the moment, I've been reading Growth by Smeal. He is, like, he's tough to get through. They're really thick books, but they're extremely interesting. And he has written one book about energy that's absolutely amazing. If you want to know anything about the energy transition, read this book. It's called, I think, A History of Energy. Let me just quickly look it up. You're editing this anyways, right?
Yeah, well, what I'll do is if you could ping me that afterwards, I'll make sure we add it to the episode link along with links, obviously, back to
Energy,
to Charge
Energy, Group. Yeah, Okay, so it's called Energy and Civilization by Vaclav Smil. It's amazing. And he has a new book out now called Growth, which is also really good. They're challenging reads. Like you'll have chapters that you want to read again and again and again to really get it. But it's extremely interesting if you want to know more about this transition. So definitely that one. I really enjoy hardcore history, which has not so much to do with the energy transition. But it's really nice. And Dan Carlin, I think he's called. They're great podcasts, really great podcasts. And let's see, what else do I read? What else do I listen to? I really like This American Life. They're extremely interesting. It's extremely interesting topics. They're a lot of fun to listen to. Okay. I'm reading a lot about ITER at the moment. I'm not sure if you've... I think this is an interesting question for you, right? Because you have all these energy people that are working in the energy vertical on, like, what are the energy projects that you're super, super interested in, super into?
I think at the moment what's personally really interesting, and a lot of our most fascinating clients, they're all, of course, fascinating, but the long-duration energy storage is really an area where we're enjoying working at the moment, and is hugely fascinating, hugely important, of course, but hugely fascinating. The various different types of chemistries and or solutions, some of which are actually based on quite traditional technologies, but used in a slightly different fashion. Everything from gravity to thermal stores and salt and everything in between. So us and for me personally, this the long duration energy storage is super fascinating at the moment.
That's super cool. I'm reading a lot about ITER, which is the fusion reactor that they're building in the south of France. That's a really interesting project to look into.
Okay. Well, listen, taking a lot of your time, I appreciate you sharing that with us, and I'll make sure we add as many of those as we can to the episode link on the podcast, which episode page, which just leaves to say, Gideon, really appreciate your time. Really great to see Peter, yourself, and the team really growing and having successes, and look forward to hopefully meeting with you at an event when we're all allowed to go.
In the near future, I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun. I hope it was useful, and hope to see you soon somewhere.
Cool. Many thanks. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Gideon van Dijk and can take something away to use for yourself and or your business. It's important to me to share these stories and insights, and from the last episode onwards, I'm publishing some key insights from each episode as a blog. So please do check those out on the website. I hope you join me for the next episode. Until then, stay safe.